This is Learning Innovation, the Teaching and Learning Podcast, also known as Little Pod. We are created by Lethbridge College's Center for Teaching, Learning, and Innovation, located in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada, on the traditional lands of the Blackfoot Confederacy. In the spirit of equity, diversity, and inclusion, and Nitsitapi Simstan, or Real Thinking, we play host to a spectrum of guests from the teaching and learning community. As we highlight and explore innovation in education, we hope to kindle warm conversations, expand perspectives, and foster lasting partnerships today, tomorrow, and beyond. The future of learning starts now. Okay, and welcome to episode number 56 of The Little Pod. Our guests today are Dr. Bhuvinder Vaid, an education developer from Capilano University in North Vancouver, and Dr. Gwen Noyen and Britt DeZoba, who are both advisors on the learning and teaching team at BC Campus in downtown Vancouver and Victoria, respectively. This trio has graciously agreed to share their knowledge and expertise about positionality, a concept that is an integral part of the teaching and learning experience. Welcome, everyone.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Donna, and the rest of your team for having us.
Thank you. And hi, everyone. My name is Gwen. I'm very happy to be with my teammate and also my friend Bhuvinder here today. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I'm very, very excited to have the three of you on the podcast today. Last December, I attended your Flow BC Campus micro course and Flow Friday webinar on positionality. And before we go further about that, I just want to mention BC Campus is a nonprofit that supports the development of teaching and learning practices amongst the BC post-secondary sector. And this micro course and the webinar, it was just a fantastic learning experience. I really enjoyed it, and I found a lot that I could apply to the work I do here at Lethbridge College. And it was amazing because I learned about the definition of positionality, the value of a positionality statement, and how to write one. So before we jump in, I'd love to hear how each of you define positionality.
Well, the definition of positionality, as I understand it, is the individual experience. And so if we think of a related concept, which is called intersectionality, that can be best understood as the all-encompassing concept or theory, which is at the macro level. Whereas positionality is at the other end of how it works and is actually experienced at the individual or micro level.
Yeah, to expand on what Bhuvinder has said, for me, positionality is a verb. So it's an action of reflection. It's the interrogation of our worldviews and how we've come to develop these views. I think it's also an understanding that we adopt different standings as we navigate the world, as we grow and learn and age, and that we are all multifaceted people with unique perspectives that impact how we approach our communities.
Oh, well, I really like the way that you said positionality is a verb, right? Because when we talk about positionality, we usually say positionality statement. And I don't like the word statement in that, in a way, because for me, it is more like a praxis. It is a process that we keep learning and reflecting on our standpoints, experiences, perspectives, and understand more about how those actually interact with each other and impact our work. So in that way, you know, in this process, it is a way for us to learn to foster a more inclusive and authentic experiences for anyone who work and learn with us.
Thank you, Gwen. That's a wonderful definition. And it's really, really helps in understanding the concept. Can you each tell me a bit about how you came to know about positionality and why it's so important, especially in your roles at Capilano and at BC Campus?
So I came about the practice of positionality when I was a graduate student at UBC. So while I was doing my master's in education, positionality was or creating a positionality statement was an assignment in pretty much all of my classes through my program. And what I enjoyed so much about the practice is in each class, you were writing a new statement and you were taking a new approach. And that's, I think, an important kind of facet to understand about positionality is it's not just writing one statement as Gwen has kind of talked about and then just leaving it at that. It's actually an iterative evergreen process that it's going to change based on the context of your learning environment, or in this case, in your work environment, or what research project you're taking on. So it's important that it is a practice. And I think throughout my master's, having to do a positionality statement in each class really got me into that mindset that we're not just copy pasting. We're actually interrogating our position in relation to the work that we're doing. And I think how this is carried into my work at BC campus is one of the amazing things about my role is I'm extremely privileged to be able to work with a variety of people across the sector. People such as Bavinder, we've gotten to work on a project together, which was awesome. My colleague Gwen, and just so many different amazing people in the education sphere. And with that, I think it's so important to continue to interrogate your positionality as you approach new projects, and especially projects that involve multitude of different communities. And just today, I was reflecting on the fact that I've been involved for the past 2 years in this big digital literacy project that's kind of overtaken my professional life, and I love it. It's my passion area. But one of the things I've noticed is I can definitely fall into this trap of assuming that everyone has the same access to technology, the same access to internet, the same access to digital literacy skills that I have. I get very much in this bubble that I think, well, we live in the day and age where everyone has a cell phone and everyone has a laptop with high-speed connection. And everyone has the same understanding of digital literacy, which is a totally false inference to make. So I think this is just one example of where continuing to interrogate your positionality and reflect on where you come, where your biases come from, and how you build your worldview, I think really creates an environment, a work environment where equity can come to the forefront a lot more easily.
Thanks, Britt. I really like that reminder of continuing to reflect on it and think about it and work on it, and that it is an iterative process.
I guess I can continue. And like Britt, I also encountered the word positionality when I did my research at the University of Victoria back in 2015. So at that time, positionality actually, you know, like I understood it as a way to emphasize the importance of researchers recognizing their unique identities and how those identities can steer their research approach in all phases. And in my previous roles as a college instructor, while I articulating many like teaching philosophies, I haven't actually deeply talked about how those stories influence my teaching practice. I only started doing this quite recently with my team at BC campus. So in the summer of 2022, when I started joining the team, we kick off with some learning circles where we share our thoughts on positionality. And yeah, we share those and we keep reviewing those together. It is so important to understand where we come from and how those personal and social identities actually play into our work. And this process kind of helped all of us at BC campus embrace the equity, diversity, and inclusion in what we do. And for me personally, it's been very eye-opening because I've gotten to know my teammates on a deeper level right at the time that I joined the team. So I understand their values, what actually drives them. And then, you know, like from there, I figure out how that we can better work alongside with each other. So it's a really beneficial practice for me on a personal level at my workplace. And from there, you know, like I learned that I am I learned more about how to interrogate the interdisciplinary approach in my work so that it allows multiple viewpoints. And it is for like multiple disciplines and multiple viewpoints come together. I also learned to invite more underrepresented voices in the field to share their perspective on different projects. For example, like digital pedagogy toolbox series that we have. And in our, you know, like flow courses and flow Fridays workshops where, you know, like we try to design and invite the voices from like different groups. Yeah. So yes, again, it is a practice. And facilitating the courses on positionality, actually, and also being here today, it is a really great chance for me to revisit and also review my old positionality. Yeah.
Well, Gwen and Britt, I'm jealous and I feel a bit bad because I arrived to the game quite late. Like, I always knew what positionality was while I was going through my PhD, but I was very dismissive of it, like in my training as a philosopher of education, saying, well, that's what other people do. That's what hippies do. And that's the first time I've ever used hippie in a sentence. For those of us that do conceptual or analytic philosophy, it's just not a thing for us. And then luckily, about halfway through my PhD writing, my dissertation writing, which was on what safe space means in higher education, I was lucky enough to meet my wife, my partner, Robin, who's a social worker with the BC Ministry of Children and Family Development. And lucky for me, they live positionality every day in regard to policy, like child protection policies and so forth, and what they actually mean depending on the specific conditions a child or family might be in. And slowly, she began to note first that my writing engaged with these very theoretical ideas of equity and intersectional difference at a very high or conceptual level without ever delving into the actual experience of what that difference might feel like at the personal or metaphorical, like ground level. Luckily, she knew something about this. So slowly through her help, I began to understand that this is something many college and university teachers, such as myself at the time, can adopt as a type of armor or defense so as not to be overwhelmed by the multitude of experiences. And these are differing experiences and possible interpretations of what we are teaching that are present in our classrooms and amongst our students. And so slowly I've begun to realize that positionality and positionality statements can be used as much as a teaching tool to dismantle our own armor, our own defensiveness as teachers. And the long answer to your very direct question is, thank you, wife. I couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you, Bhuvinder. Good plug in there for your wife. I really love the different ways that you've all come to positionality and the experiences that you've had with it. Gwen, I really like that you mentioned the learning circles and also as an added benefit of sharing positionality, getting to know your colleagues better. That's really fantastic. Why do you think it's so important for educators to be aware of and engage with positionality?
I think I can jump in first in this question. I believe that it is very important for educators to engage in this practice because first thing is promotes the self-reflection and critical awareness of our own biases, assumptions, and perspective. And from there, we gain deeper understanding of our personal place-based social identities and how those impact our teaching practice. And the second thing is when we are more mindful of how we position in our teaching practices in the way that we interact with the students, it is the very first step that we become more ready to create an inclusive and transformative classroom environment for the students. So for example, as a person who come from ethnic group in Canada, so I'm more mindful the challenges that international students might face in academic, for example. And I learned to, from there, I learned like to offer different ways of engagement in my course for the students. And I learned to be flexible with my projects in the classroom because I know that some students might have problems with language barriers or, you know, like the culture of the time, for example, of deadline and time. Last but not least, I think that all educators are not only the classroom teachers, because we are educators as well as social agents. So in this process, we start to invite ourselves as well as our peers and other students to recognize and challenge the systemic inequality within the educational system and working towards a more equitable and inclusive for all.
I really like how you put it. We're social agents. And even at a more basic level, we're human beings teaching, trying to teach other human beings. And we have to accept that the content, whatever it might be that we're teaching, if it didn't need to be interpreted in that teaching and learning act, we'll all be replaced by AI. We can just have an automaton, a computer, reading the page to the students, and that's it. But the reality is, knowledge has to be interpreted. Knowledge has to be shared. And that's what we do as a teacher. And therefore, we need to know where we are coming from, and more importantly, how we are sharing, why we are sharing certain points that we feel are more important than others. Going one step further, in regard to now thinking about the positionality of myself, the next step is to then think about the positionality of my students. That becomes almost a natural extension. And this can really help me understand as a teacher, maybe why some students aren't getting it, in quotation marks, in that, are they not intelligent enough? Do they lack certain skills or learning habits? Or could it be that they come from a slightly different perspective? They're coming from somewhere else, not physically necessarily, not necessarily emotionally, not necessarily cognitively, but they're coming from a different perspective. And being able to recognize that can allow myself to be less static or less stagnant in my teaching and be more receptive to the fact that, you know, I need to change as well as anyone else in order to be able to interpret and share this knowledge that I'm trying to teach.
Wow, Bhuvinder, I feel like if you could see my mind right now, it would have that like brain exploding kind of thing. Like, wow, okay, that I love how you picked up on the social agents and then as well sort of knowledge being interpreted. This, I'm still learning about this. There's so many levels to this and layers to this. And yeah, that's really fantastic.
Yeah, I'm always in awe, my colleagues, of just how intelligent and introspective and wonderful they are. And I'm always learning something new. But I think the only thing I would add to that is to build off of what Bhuvinder said about AI. I think positionality is a practice that really builds and deepens empathy. And that's something with AI that, you know, AI can do wonderful things. I don't see empathy inherently built into AI. And that's something as facilitators, instructors, educators, that we can do better than you know, any computer. And I think a lot of the learning that happens in the classroom or learning or in an educational setting, it's not just about the content, but it's about learning how to be a part of a community, how to empathize with your fellow learner, how to understand that other people are coming from different perspectives. So that learning can really start with the educator. That's how you can start off your learning environment, is by reflecting on your own positionality and where you're coming to the learning environment from as well. And I think that really helps build empathy for your student. And if you bring that practice into the classroom, I think that really helps your student build empathy for one another as well.
Thank you, Britt. I'm glad that you mentioned empathy as well. All of what you're mentioning, I really found valuable, you know, because I teach our diversity in education course here at the college, and it's part of our instructor certification program. And I really felt like after taking the workshop with the three of you that positionality piece is the piece that's missing. It's a really key piece that's missing from that course. And so I've since I last saw you, have been bringing that into the course, bringing that into the course outcomes, and bringing those pieces into the course, because I really feel like it's so important and so valuable, and it was something that was missing there previously. One thing I found is, you know, you talked about the value of a positionality statement. And as I was going through the workshop, I thought, okay, all right. And then when it came time to actually write it, it was like, oh, okay, this is a little tougher than I was thinking. So can we talk a little bit about the positionality statement and, you know, maybe what's important to mention? I don't know if you want to talk about your own positionality statement or to dive into that, because it's important to know about positionality and to share that as an educator. But then that positionality statement is another level.
Yeah, I want to recognize that it's hard work. It sounds simple on paper, but it's hard work. And it's an iterative process too. So I think through the course, Gwen and I hopefully tried to communicate is that this is by no means something that you are ever going to get perfect or should even aim to have it to be perfect. It should be, it's a practice. It's not a finalized document. And one of the ways that you can explore positionality, it doesn't even have to be a written statement. Gwen and I have done workshops before on the practice of art-based positionality and creating an art piece that reflects the different layers of your intersectionality and how you approach the world, because sometimes there's aspects of our personhood that just aren't easily expressed in words. I think with arts-based approaches, it can also be really impactful practice for students as well, because sometimes it can be uncomfortable to delve into these aspects of our personhood. So taking a UDL, a Universal Design for Learning approach, and allowing yourself and students to really approach positionality from whatever creative angle feels most comfortable to you, I think it's a great way to get started. I think just starting with some of the maybe, I don't know, I found when I started this process, just starting with who am I? Like if I were to describe myself, who am I? Listing down these attributes, whether, you know, they're important things like physicality, but also, you know, I'm a neurodiverse person and my heritage and my education level, but also my values and what's important to me, listing these all out and then kind of going from there. Does it feel natural to craft this into a statement? And in some instances, you do need to provide a statement. Like in research, you would most typically have to write a positionality statement in a very traditional sense. But if it's in an education setting or in a work setting, there's probably more flexibility to try out new modalities like poetry, painting, a video, you know, a podcast. There's different ways you can play around with it. And we really encourage that.
I'm not keen on templates, but I am keen on lists. And if you were just to Google personal identities or list of personal identities, possible personal identities, or list of social identities, you end up getting a pretty long, it's almost like a clearinghouse of different things you could consider about yourself, be it gender, sexuality, ethnic background, education, neurodiversity, like the list goes on and on and on. In the end, though, or maybe not before, maybe before you get to the end, somewhere in the middle when you're getting started, you can write all these things down, but then you have to consider, well, what do I feel comfortable sharing? Coupled with that is, what's the purpose of sharing? Like, how will this benefit my audience, my students, to hear about me? And where I am coming from and who I am and where I'm coming from. And if that invokes empathy on their part toward me, how will I develop empathy for them? And so really considering that as a first step? What's the pedagogical reason for developing and then sharing your positionality statement?
Thanks, Bhuvinder. I think those are really great points because, I mean, you could share endlessly about yourself, but it's important to know, I guess, for that context, what you're willing to share and what's important to share.
So one of the small activities usually in my workshops or in the course that I engage the participants with is actually from the book. This book is Anti-Racist by Tiffany Jewell. So in the next 3 to 5 minutes, write out everything that you can think of that make who you are. The same thing as Britt said. And then this activities is usually I don't ask participants to share, but it is a way to invite them to reflect on the identities beyond the way that they usually introduce themselves. So for example, I usually give an example of myself. I'm a learning advisor at BC campus. Besides that, I realized that I'm also a mother of two. I am a daughter. I am a haiku practitioner. I am the Vietnamese first immigrant in the first generation immigrant in Canada. I love learning and sharing. So for example, something like that. And then starting with that very first activities, we usually come to the next activities where we delve deeper into how significant of each identities actually interact with the way that I teach and what type of training or experiences I have and in what way that this shape my teaching approaches and the way that I design the assessment activity, for example. And then, you know, like it go on and on in our learning circles. And then towards the end, I realized that each of us have different ways express ourselves and finding way to reflect on those. So Britt, really comfortable with the collage, right, Britt? The digital collage, for example. And then other people are very comfortable with sharing their traditional statement. And I feel more comfortable to move around with my poetic inquiry in finding ways about myself. So I think, you know, like starting with the small step and we move towards the one with, are you comfortable with shift with such inquiry in understanding about those positionality statement? Yeah.
Thank you, Gwen. And thank you. Thank you, all three of you. That is really helpful in, you know, helping people think about how they would, well, I guess, reflect themselves and then start to consider, you know, how they're going to share that and what is important to share. And I really like the idea of the learning circles and having that discussion. Do you find that sharing a positionality statement encourages students to share or to open up more or engage with that?
Am I allowed to say it depends? Because technically, I've sat and I've thought about this a lot. There's three different things happening with a positionality statement when we choose to share it with our students. And the first is, as a teacher, I'm explicitly discussing my presence and what is visible to the students and what is invisible. By that, I mean silent identities that aren't clearly visible to those that are staring at me as a bald brown man. Like, oh, he's this in addition to being brown and bald, because that's the visual identity that they see immediately. Beyond the explicit sharing, implicitly what I'm hoping for my students is that they're able to begin to recognize similarities between themselves and I. And I could be speaking to some of my past students, some of my current students, or my future students through this positionality statement. What I'm hoping for implicitly, is that they are beginning to see some similarities to me. And this develops a sense of belonging by recognizing many of the visible, but actually more of the invisible student identities that are also in the room. I've named it as being invisible in me. Perhaps it's invisible to those in the room as well. But the part that always becomes the problematic, or the why I said it depends, is the aspirational, in that by sharing my positionality statement, I have an explicit intent, I have an implicit intent, and then aspirational. I'm hoping the students learn to begin recognizing invisible or even absent identities beyond their own. They start seeing each other, not just me, the instructor, but each other. That is sometimes the most difficult work to do in a classroom, because that's something that has to be scaffolded, continually worked on to build that empathy for each other. And having them begin to develop their own positionality statements is one way to do this, but it's not the only way. And I'd love to hear what Britt and Gwen have to share, or their ideas on this, because I really do worry about instructors that have a positionality statement, they share it, and they assume, now my students know how to see each other.
Yeah, I would say a positionality statement is not like a practice that is going to immediately result in instant empathy building among students. I think it's one approach, as Bhavinder has said. And also, I think it's situational. There may be courses that you teach that it's not necessarily appropriate. I think we have to recognize that not that there are parts of our identity that we are fully allowed to keep private and don't want to share with students, and shouldn't expect students to have to share with us or among themselves just for the end goal of building course community. And so I think positionality statements, while I will always advocate them as a great tool for instructor development, and I think we have to view them as that, though they're one tool. And I think approaching them with intentionality is important as well. And being intentional with when you bring positionality for statements or the practice of reflecting on positionality into your classroom.
Thank you, Britt. And while this question is among the most tricky questions, you know, like in this, and can you believe Donna and Britt, actually Bhavinder emailed us and asked about, you know, like, because when we claim that positionality contributes to the student's success, based on one of the articles from Christine Harrington, that, you know, like drafting positionality, sharing it through the syllabus or any course activity, it can, you know, like kind of connect the students together, kind of develop their, you know, like reflexivity activities in the classroom. But if you ask me in what way that is beneficial students, we don't have number. We haven't done any empirical examination. You see, you know, like this is the number of the success of the student or the course who actually integrate positionality into their coursework. But from, you know, like those articles, it's kind of develop empathy. It shows, you know, like the students can develop their own self-reflection. And it is a way to enhance the diversity and inclusivity, encourage the critical engagement with the course materials. So I go with one point, which is encourage the critical engagement with the course material in a way that, so for example, if I allow the use of generative AI in my coursework, and then my standpoint is as a second language writer and learner, so I found that generative AI actually, you know, like kind of helping with some editing skills or, you know, like with some of the writing process, for example, is kind of, you know, like help the writer blocks. So if I do like that, and then I share from my experience with it, and then I choose to integrate generative AI in my writing assignments in a way that the student can graph with AI, share their prompting, and then several, you know, like, for example, like several drafts of their assignments and collaborate with others. And from there, they develop the one that can best answer to the question or something, show their perspective. But when I share my, you know, like my approaches, why I believe that it should be used in the course is kind of help the student engage with such activity at more critical level. And then they also, in a way that it invite the student to share their credible critical standpoints around the assignments as well. So this is what I believe. And I think in some way that it opened up the conversation and fostered the relationship in the way that they work together.
I really love that you have mentioned positionality and AI, and I wouldn't initially have brought those two concepts together, but it completely makes sense. And of course, anyone who works in education right now, AI is at the top of the topic and conversation list and top of mind. So I really like that connection that you've made with the two.
I don't mean that we should just go for it 100% for generative AI in the coursework. But I think it is important as an educator to state our standpoint. And why do we adopt such standpoint for, you know, like some learning technologies and including generative AI? So for example, if I adopted that AI technology in my coursework because I experienced it and I see the benefits for the second language writer or communicator in a way, then in that way, it developed the trust and the transparency and the understanding among, you know, like myself and the students. So just an example.
So to add to what Gwen said, generative AI is inherently biased. So I think the practice of positionality and understanding our own implicit biases can help uncover the biases that are hidden among generative AI tools, which can often be tricky to uncover. So this is one way that positionality as a tool can help students be more critical and engage more critically with some of the new technical tools that are coming out.
And I love this conversation because it immediately made me think of how a lot of my colleagues are grappling with generative AI as they rethink their teaching or parts of their teaching, the recognition that generative AI can help students hone their critical thinking. So it's not necessarily the product or the end result, it's how they get there. And using AI kind of like a coach, or borrowing from Microsoft, a co-pilot on that learning journey. And this reminds me of something that Britt said earlier, where a positionality statement can aid in the development of empathy. But there's a double-edged sword with that, because we often believe that empathy is innate. It's something that comes naturally to us as human beings. And that is true so long as we see the similarities between us and the other. We can empathize. But when we can't see those similarities, they're invisible or they're absent, then it becomes really difficult to empathize with that invisible or absent other. And so thinking of the positionality statement that we offer, asking students to consider invisible and absent identities that maybe they don't know much about, and then going one step further, something along the lines of, as Gwen put it, when she's asking students to think about all the different things that they are. As a step, like how would they get to a positionality statement? Much the same way as we get to a positionality statement. A lot of heavy lifting, a lot of work, as Britt said earlier, it's hard. Being able to develop small activities where students are doing that type of hard work, and they could be doing it with AI, where AI is just asking them questions about their assumptions, to really start to develop one, their own positionality statement, but two, that empathy for the absent, invisible other that we all hope or aspire to with our positionality statement. But unless we do more work with it, unless we do the groundwork with our students, they won't necessarily get there on their own.
So there might even be a way with AI to maybe create some prompts that would help students reflect on that.
Very much so. And if that's not the case, Britt, Gwen, should we put in for a grant and give that a try?
Yeah, we can come up with a positionality bot.
Well, and Gwen, too, as you were talking about some of the papers, and I thought, ooh, it seems like there's some potential SODL projects and research also with around positionality, and then maybe adding AI in there as well. So have any of you experienced any aha moments with your students where you've shared your positionality statement and they've connected with it somehow?
From our course, I think, you know, like we received really from our course on positionality statement, but not, you know, like undergraduate student or mainly student facing, is for educators who facilitate learning online mainly. But we received really good feedback from the course that you were in, Donna. And people said that, you know, like they could adapt this activity in their coursework. They think that it is the place, you know, like where the student, they envision that it should be used as an icebreaker in, you know, like in the first day of the class, for example, or some of them actually have tried the wheels of privileges or biases. And these activities, you know, kind of create a way for the students to reflect on themselves, develop the empathy for each other, and, you know, like knowing that the strong commitment of the class towards a more inclusive classroom, for example. So those are some of the feedback that we received from our previous course. But other than that, maybe, you know, like Bhuvinder, you can jump in if you have any experience sharing the positionality with faculties or the students at your college.
Thank you, Gwen. So as an educational developer, I'm doing primarily professional development for faculty who are then teaching. But my background is a higher education instructor as well. And I remember many, many instances of standing there day one of class with my undergraduate students, reading my positionality statement, being so proud of it, and saying, oh, I'm sharing so much good stuff. And the students would nod their heads and smile, and they would have no idea what to do with it, other than saying later in the student feedback, our professor overshares. And it was then that I realized that a positionality statement's purpose is not to provoke or instill in a student. And positionality statement is what we've realized about ourselves through that critical reflection that we've undertaken and we are now sharing with others. And so this goes back to Britt, Gwen, and myself. We all advocate that if we want students or instructors to be able to do this, they have to be able to do that critical reflective work, that hard, that heavy lifting. And so if I share a positionality statement, the next thing I'm doing is not, okay, go write your own. It's here's a little bit of the thinking and reflection that went into it. And I guide my students through an activity to try to replicate some of that thinking so that they're better able to begin to have those aha moments of their own.
Yeah, I think that Bhuvinder touches upon something really important where positionality or writing a positionality statement isn't the same as an introduction. It's not the same as Jeff telling somebody your life story. It's a purposeful tool to interrogating the way that you approach your work and the way that you see the world. So I think if you're bringing positionality statements into the classroom, it's important to explain the why. Like, why are we doing this? It's not just to get to know your fellow students better. It's also a critical skill that you're building. It's also a way to interrogate not only your own worldview, but the worldview of the research and the writers and the academics that you're gonna come across through your program of study. I think it's a way to build critical engagement. It's not just an icebreaker activity, although it is a way of getting to know one another through your worldview, but it has a pedagogical implication as well.
Britt, I'm glad you also mentioned research there, and I'd like to jump into that side of it as well. you mentioned positionality statements from having done your graduate research. And at Lethbridge College, we have a growing number of research projects. As a college, we're starting to do more and more research in a number of different areas. And during the micro-credential, you mentioned the tie between positionality and academic research. And so I'm wondering if the three of you might talk a little bit about that side, so positionality in connection with research.
So in the context of research, positionality actually involves recognizing the researcher's background, experiences, social identities, and how they shape the research question, the ways that they choose the methods for research, and then the way that they analyze those data and interpret those data. So in teaching practice, it's a bit different because it is a way for educators to understand their identities and then in what way that those impact their teaching preparation, design, and also the way they deliver the lessons. So knowing that both in research and education, it encourages the transparency, reflexivity, and also a strong commitment to an ethical practice for both. But because I think that, you know, like it going back to why positionality always make us think about academic research, because it is a practice that usually unconsciously make us think about something very intellectual and insightful. And so when Bhuvinder actually contacted us and then asking about what kind of tools that we use, you know, like to for this practice, and Britt and I shared that we rely on arc-based inquiry so that we can share this, you know, like positionality practice. It is a way for people to, you know, like to kind of vision and then, you know, like revision their identities, reflect on those. Relying on some pens, some tools, and then it doesn't have to be a very intellectual and academic papers and a very, for example, very professional and rigid paper. It can be, you know, like something small as, you know, like we share a faces that, you know, like that kind of show our different identities as a teacher, for example. This is my thoughts on how, you know, like when we think of positionality, we often think about research-based and intellectual-based.
I think you touched on something important there, Gwen, with ethics. I think one of the important facets of including a positionality statement in your research is it's a way of holding yourself accountable and introducing yourself to your reader. So in a teaching and learning setting, when we're working with students or other educators, there's an interpersonal connection there because we're probably in a learning setting where we can actually see each other or interact over email or over Zoom. But when you're reading a research paper, you're not in the room with the researcher. You're not seeing them. You're not interacting with them. So as a researcher, including a positionality statement is a way of introducing yourself, but also holding yourself accountable to your research and explaining to readers how you've approached your research with what worldview you're applying to your research and allowing your readers to come to understand where you might have biases. So it's showing that you acknowledge that you will have biases that are being applied to this research, but also allowing your readers an opportunity to come to understand those biases as well. And traditionally, I think in research, a positionality statement would be a lot more professional than, or a lot more structured than what teaching and learning environment might allow. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of academic publications allow you to include a collage or, you know, a video or a painting, which is too bad because that would be lovely. But I think the practice is still very important from a researcher, even if it is a more rigid and professional statement, because it is truly a way of holding yourself accountable to some of the biases that you may apply to your research.
Well, I just say a lot of my current work has been on decolonization and indigenization. And I recognize there's no way I could have gotten here to what I'm working on currently without having engaged in that hard critical work that Britt and Gwen have spoken of, to craft my positionality statement, to really think of the ahas that have led to what I'm willing and able to share now, so that I'm open to knowledge that at times seems so different. And here I speak of Indigenous knowledge that seems at first so different from what I've been trained in that Anglo-European philosophy sense, until I begin to empathize or extend to this knowledge that, oh, wait, hold on, that's actually something that speaks to me, maybe not at a conceptual level or at that philosophical intellectual level. It speaks to me somewhere else in my soul or my body, and I find meaning there. And there's no way I'd be able to approach the work I'm trying to do in indigenization here at CAPU and for myself without having gone through this process. So if there's a link between positionality statements or positionality academic research and decolonization, indigenization, all I would say is, for me, it starts with thinking about ourselves and beginning to work on and understand and share our own positionality.
That's a great point, Bhuvinder. And as I listened to the three of you, it also made me think, you know, we were talking about positionality in relationship to research and in relationship to teaching, but certainly in my job, there's other people who work on education. I'm a learning experience designer. We have instructional designers. I'm sure in your roles, you have others that maybe aren't directly teaching, but it actually, as you talk about positionality, I think it's the way it's important for everyone to reflect on how they're approaching, whether it's curriculum design or course design, because I think that probably has an impact on all of that.
Oh, very, very much so. We teach or reproduce in the design of our teaching what we know or what we assume others are capable of. And we often don't think of what is invisible amongst our students or what is absent amongst maybe some of our students. Just because I have a student doesn't mean I'll have that type of student again and again and again. And if all I'm able to do is reproduce what I know and how I've experienced it and how I've taught it without being reflexive to the fact that I need to change to meet my students where they are, I'm doing a disservice to the act of teaching.
Yes, and thank you for that, Bhuvinder. And again, going back to the practice, positionality, it takes, like Britt said, it takes time, and definitely it takes a lot of resources, efforts, vulnerability for this, you know, like practice. And very often we are not in the same level of sharing discomfort or vulnerability. So, and especially when we, you know, collaborate on learn and teach together in this digital space, lots of concern about, you know, how much can we disclose, you know, our personal information on this. And I understand that, you know, requiring the students and instructors or, you know, program administrator to engage in the positionality statement, especially with the government standards or outcome, can be quite tricky. It requires really careful consideration and constraint of those programs to, you know, cultivate a really comprehensive curriculum to, you know, to that. But again, it doesn't have to be something big. Actually, it can start, you know, very small. For example, at small professional development event, and then we start sharing. We invite others to share, you know, a moment to reflect on their identities, personal experience, and the reason why they come to the room, for example. And then, you know, from there, we hope that those can go out and then share some with the students or their peers in the same way. And it's the very first important thing, I think, is demonstrate how we commit towards an open, diverse and inclusive education environment. It shows how we strongly commit towards, you know, like ethics in this educational setting. And everything cannot be changed overnight or day, definitely. But I think it's the walk that really matter. It's not the destination. And one of the quotes that I really love, and I normally, you know, like say in my workshop, is hope is like a road in the country. So there's never a road, but when people walk on it, the road comes into existence. So the hope, you know, like for some transformational changes in our educational setting can be the road when we all can walk together.
Gwen always has the most beautiful poetic quotes. I am so fortunate to get to work with Gwen every day because my poetry list has grown. While Gwen was talking, it reminded me of the fact that you don't have to necessarily start by bringing the practice of positionality directly into your classroom and to start with your students. As Bhavinder said, it's the work that starts with yourself first. But one thing that we've done at BC Campus that might be helpful is we kind of started our own little community of practice around positionality within staff. So on our learning and teaching team, I think this is back, yeah, when Gwen first joined the team, I did a little presentation just for our learning and teaching team at BC Campus about positionality statements. We went away, we all started our first draft. And then I think a month or two later, we came back. We talked about the challenges. It was totally optional to share. You didn't have to share, but what was important was talking about the process and talking about the challenges, not so much what the end product was. And some really great conversations came out of that about what do we include in a positionality statement? You know, oh, I have this element that I want to talk about, but I'm not quite sure how to phrase it. And just bouncing those ideas off of one another creates a sense of community around this practice. And then we went away again, worked on it some more, came back another month later, had a session, workshopped it as a group. And honestly, it was a wonderful team building experience. And it also builds the practice of positionality as iterative. It is the road that you build along the way. It's not about the destination. It's a practice, truly. And so I just want to pose that as one suggestion. If you're interested in starting with positionality, I would start with yourself. But it's also great to build community around that and get some practice with colleagues.
I really love that idea. I think that's fantastic. And I can see that really creating quite a supportive environment as well. Would you like to share your positionality statements?
I'm a very bad reader, but I will read my poem aloud. From Far Eastern Place, I came here as an immigrant with stories of a Vietnamese golden-skinned girl who wishes to find her voice and freedom by traversing towards the lane of possibilities, towards the rising sun. I have nothing but some broken English and a bucket full of courage to learn, love, and nourish myself. The soul that has no color, but beautiful like a rainbow, happy like blue sky over my head, gentle like green grass under my toe. In my everyday being and becoming, I want to stop and listen with imperfections, not to respond, but to be changed. Thank you.
Wonderful, Gwen. Thank you.
As we were talking about earlier, there's so many things that can be included in a positionality statement. But one thing I've learned from my work, decolonization and indigenization work, is the importance of place-based knowledge and place-based experience. So I've begun working on and experimenting with a place-based positionality statement that incorporates my land acknowledgement. Because often we can offer a land acknowledgement and not talk about our relationship to what it actually means. So here I go. My name is Bhavinder Singh Bain. He, him, his are the specific pronouns I go by. And I am an uninvited settler of Indian, specifically Punjabi descent, living and working on the unceded and stolen territory of the Lillooet, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. I share this little part of myself and my relationship to these unceded territories and stolen lands to acknowledge the debt I owe to the fact that my family has generated economic wealth and social benefit as immigrants in the 1970s because of our ability to purchase and sell this land. So quite simply, the accrued benefits of my lifetime, my education, my family, my overall well-being, are a result of people such as the Lillooet, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh being forcibly denied any rights to their own land so that others, namely myself, could reap the benefits.
Thank you, Bhavinder. Wow.
It's so hard to follow both of your amazing positionality statements. I'll say that in the recent months, I've been exploring positionality through arts-based approaches. I came from a family that loved art. I grew up with a mom who practiced many, many different forms of art. And so I had a very fortunate childhood where creativity was always encouraged. And I think that's something I've lost touch with through the years as I've focused on other pursuits in my life. And now I'm really bringing that creative spirit back and incorporating that with my practice of positionality. And unfortunately, because podcasting is an auditory medium and not a visual medium, I can't share my digital art space positionality statement with you today. But I did prepare a written positionality statement that has influenced the design of my arts-based positionality statement. So my name is Britt Zoba. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a white settler on the unceded, meaning never surrendered, ancestral and occupied traditional homelands of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking people, which is colonially known as Burnaby, BC. However, I was born and raised on the traditional and unceded territory of the Lekungan ancestors and families, the Esquimalt and Songhees nations, which is now so-called Victoria. My childhood was spent running through the dune grass on the beaches of the Salish Sea, climbing the gnarled limbs of the agari oaks that lined our street, and laughing as I chased peacocks across the cricket pitch on Meakin, which is now known as Beacon Hill Park. I developed a close relationship with the land, both through my outdoor explorations in my community and because of my familial history. My ancestry has a mix of European descent, but I'm primarily Ukrainian. My family and myself have benefited greatly, both from a safety and economic standpoint, for the opportunity to settle in Canada. And this privilege has come out of a long history of violent colonialism. It is my responsibility to continue to learn about and interrogate my own role in colonization as it persists today, particularly in the realm of higher education. I'm a queer, cisgendered woman, and I'm neurodivergent. Currently, I'm employed at BC Campus as a learning and teaching advisor, where I'm privileged to work with a variety of educational specialists across the sector on wonderful educational development projects with people such as Gwen and Bhavinder.
Amazing, Britt. Thank you. Well, thank you, all of you. Thank you, Gwen and Bhavinder and Britt. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure talking with you today. I appreciate so much all that you've shared and the knowledge that you've shared. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a fantastic experience. And once again, I have learned so much today from Gwen and Bhavinder. Every time we talk about positionality, I feel like I learned something new, and it's just such an enriching process. So I'm very grateful for both of you and for you, Donna, and for Jordana as well for bringing us on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I really appreciate this, Donna, you know, like Jordana as well, you know, like for open up as well as, you know, like invite us to this sustained conversation on positionality, I think it is a really great start towards, you know, like what we commit towards a more equitable and inclusive and meaningful learning and teaching experiences for all. Yeah.
If anyone who's listening heard our positionality statement said, oh, damn, that's how can I craft mine in that way? This is years in the making and countless iterations and revisions and so on and so forth. Just try. Like, just do your best and share, because it's the act of sharing that matters, not necessarily how well it's crafted or so forth, because that's what your students and your audience will appreciate.
This episode featured Donna McLaughlin as host and Britt DeZoba, Gwen Noyen, and Bhuvinder Vaid as guests. Jordana Gagnon was our producer. Ryan Robinson was our sound technician and editor. Our podcast is funded by Lethbridge College's Center for Teaching, Learning, and Innovation and recorded on the traditional lands of the Blackfoot Confederacy. For more episodes, head to our website, learninginnovation.ca. Thanks for listening and take care.